Wow, what a great job by our students. Zach, wonderful job, man. To get up here and at your age to do what you did with such poise was awesome. Riley, where'd you go? Great job, Riley, if you're here. Great job even if you aren't here. And thanks for the question about the Disney princesses. Awkwardness is the lifeblood of the church. Remember that. So it is so good to be with you on Student Ministry Sunday. We got something pretty cool and special planned for you, but I need you to crack open your Bibles to Ephesians for a minute. We have been going through Ephesians together, simply a remarkable book, and I want to spend a few minutes in chapter 5 and then in chapter 6 for a couple different reasons. One is the passage on wives and husbands is always just tough, so I think we need to take another minute and spend some time in it, okay? And that is, do you know what I'm talking about? When it says something, Paul says something specifically to wives. He says, wives, obey. I love it. Submit, right? And then if we're chauvinists, then men, what we do is go, we amen that, right? That's right. Finally, somebody telling my wife what she should do. And we don't go on to the place that says, because he starts, he says, wives, I have something to say to you. And then he says, husbands, I have something to say to you. And what I have to say to you is what? Love. Fire hose your wife with love the way that Christ loved the church. Now, this entire section, because remember, chapters, verses, all that, that was an invention later to help referencing in Scripture. So in this letter to the Ephesians, Paul talks about roles in the family and in society. And there's something really, really important you've got to understand if you're going to understand these sections at all. You have to understand what Paul understood about power, okay? I've said to you before, when a couple comes to me and they're going to get married, one of the questions I would ask them, that I ask them, is what kind of a marriage do you want? And they're usually, what are you talking about? So I'll say, you have come to me because I am a believer in Christian marriage. I can put you on the path to Christian marriage. In fact, the way that I will marry you when we go through a ceremony is I won't just take you down to a justice of the peace and have you sign a license, because that's simply a legality. I will bring you before God because, number one, I believe there is one. Number two, I believe marriage is his idea and that he is the only one who can enforce a marriage covenant. So I will bring you before God and you will make promises before God. But in order to make promises before God, you have to be in relationship to God. Otherwise, promises before him mean nothing. And the only way you can be in relationship with God is how? By submitting to the lordship of his Son, Jesus Christ, who he sent. So do you see all of the things that are already going on before we ever have a wedding ceremony? There are a lot of assumptions being made. And one of the assumptions is that both people who are going to stand before God understand what a relationship with God is like because they understand Jesus Christ, his Son. If they understand Jesus Christ, his Son, then at some point, hopefully, they will reflect back on Philippians chapter 2 that tells us what Jesus was like, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped or held on to, but made himself nothing. What just happened in Ephesians, what just happened in Philippians, what happened from the God of the universe is he showed what happens in the best way to handle power. The best way to handle power, and Jesus had it all, is to lay it down for the well-being of someone else. That's not just a good idea. That's not just a suggestion for you when things get real bad. That's the only way a marriage works. Okay? When two people stand before God, God says, there's got to be order. We cannot have chaos in the world. I can't just say, go and do whatever you want to do. Whatever you guys decide is right, go do that. There needs to be order. God established order. He said, wives, submit to the order I'm creating. I am telling the husband to fire hose love you in a sacrificial giving way that Jesus did. You come underneath that. Don't take your power and fight against it. You take your power and lay it down. You're going, okay, Mark, I get it. Good, I hope you do. And I hope next week you get it better. And I hope 3 months from now you get it even better than that. Because it also is a picture for what Paul is going to say later. And this is a passage we had people specifically ask us about. Do you have any idea where I'm going with this? Ephesians chapter 6. Masters and slaves. Okay? So look at Ephesians chapter 6 for just a minute. In verse 1, it says this. By the way, I hope you're never offended that I print scripture out because this is way too small for me to read, okay? So I love the Bible, and I have mine right here, and I read it, okay? But I print it out just so you know. People get picky about things in churches. I know that. All right. Verse 1 of chapter 6, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Another description of a relationship of power. Right? Parents, pretty easy to see. You have the opportunity to have power over your children. And that's an easy one, because even early on, it's even pictured physically. I don't like what Tommy's doing when he's 2. I grab him. I pick him up. I pull him away from that. He's 6'2", 185 now. I don't pick him up and pull him away from anything. But at one time, I could even exercise physical power. Children, obey. Submit to what your parents are teaching in the Lord. With the assumption that parents under... And you say, how do you know that, Mark? How do you know that's an in the Lord? Because then he's going to go on and even address fathers and say, by the way, fathers, you have power over your children. You know what? Don't use it to provoke them. Don't use it to make them angry. Don't frustrate them. Don't exasperate them. And then Paul turns to bondservants, ESV says in verse 5, chapter 6. Bondservants, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart as you would Christ, not by the way of eye service as people pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ doing the will of God from the heart. Rendering service with a good will as to the Lord and not to man. Okay, I'm just going to take a second. A big mistake we make when we read this passage is we look at this passage as Paul's complete and final word on slavery. It is not. What Paul is saying as a as an acknowledgement of a very real socioeconomic situation of slavery in his day, Paul is saying, and he even said earlier in Ephesians 5, we don't know how long we have till Christ is coming back. So the question wasn't about let's drop everything and abolish slavery. He was simply answering the question, how should a slave who has become a believer continue to act? And what he said is, he said, number one, he reminds all of us, we may not feel like it, but we are all slaves. We are either slaves to the prince of the power of the air, or when we render our lives to Christ, we are slaves to him. Paul says, slave, if you have rendered your life to Christ, then recognize that the service you are rendering, even to your master, is actually service to Jesus Christ. But even then, Paul has instruction to masters in the passage. He says, masters, don't be harsh with your slaves. So what I don't want you to ever do with this passage is to say, see, the Bible justifies slavery. It absolutely does not. In fact, it's the entire counsel of Scripture that caused America and many other nations to understand that slavery was a societal evil and people needed to be liberated from slavery. But Paul in no way here is defending slavery. And I want you to understand that. And as you talk in your community groups, many of you are doing the Ephesians series and you're talking, dive deeper into these relationships and how they relate to power. Okay? But this is Student Ministry Sunday. And I want to make sure, first of all, I want you guys to understand why we love students the way we do at CCC. I don't know that you know this, but I was actually the first full-time student minister hired by CCC. That was my very first job in 1992. There was a part-time guy, a guy named Joe Coffey. He was the part-time student ministries guy. He was tired because he was also the chaplain full-time at Cuyahoga Valley Christian Academy. And so he said, hey, let's hire a guy full-time because we want someone who will pay specific attention to our students and help them to come into a saving relationship with Jesus and then grow in discipleship. And so they hired me. And by the way, just quick side note, we also ended up hiring Pastor Joe as an assistant, and that worked out pretty well as well. All right? So this is back in 1992. That's when I first got hired. As we were talking about Student Ministry Sunday, I thought it would be fun. I asked Will and Tim, I said, what were you guys doing in 1992 when I was hired to run student ministries? So here's what they were doing. That's what Will was doing, okay? I like to say he was looking an awful lot like Sawyer is what he was doing. And what was Tim doing? Tim was starting his gun collection in 1992. I tell you, that's fun. It's fun to see that, but I also tell you that because it has been important for me as a student ministries guy to know that although there was a time I tried to stay significantly connected with students and their thinking, I'm a bit removed from that day. In fact, I'm a bit removed from my own time in middle school. I want to show you what that time looked like, a time when glasses and that kind of look were, I'm still not sure what linebacker I borrowed that blazer from, but Now, it's been a long time since I've been in student ministries. So what I've asked today, I've asked Tim and I've asked Will if they would come, because I want them to help us get inside the life of a student that we are trying to minister to. Guys, thanks. And thanks for coming this morning. Great to have you guys here. For some of you who are fairly new, let me give you a quick background of what's going on, why we have two different guys up here. Will is the very first guy we hired here at this campus to be our full-time student ministries guy. So Will has had a lot of time, and then a lot of time with our students. And then as Will has transitioned into other things in his life, we knew that we needed to find somebody to step in and continue that work. And Tim is a recent answer to our prayers. Tim Huben is with that. So what you're seeing right now in our campus is kind of the handing off of the baton as well. But I wanted you to hear from both of these guys because of what great work you guys have both done and the insights that you have. So so good to have you guys this morning. All right, let's jump in. What I think would be really great to do, I would love it if you would take us, and Tim, I'll let you start us with this, but if you would kind of take us inside the life of a student right now. Most of us are not students, so help us see and feel the world that you see and feel when you're working with students.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of this information, especially for those who have parents whose kids are in middle school and high school, you've heard a lot of this, but for the majority of the church, you may not know this. This generation is called Generation Z, and that includes those born between 1995 and 2012. So if you have a kid that is between the age of 6 and 23, you have a Gen Z. They make up 24.3% of the population. They have an 8-second attention span, which is good. they believe that education is a key to gaining a better life. The majority of Gen Zs are preparing for college much earlier than previous generations, and they do good deeds. 60% of them want their jobs to impact the world. So there are a lot of really good facts. I would encourage you to look them up. But some of the things that we want to talk about are areas in which there are struggles in school. I took a survey of 20 of our own students here, and when asked what are the three biggest issues facing your generation, there was one sixth grader wrote anxiety, depression, and stress, which is, to me in sixth grade, I was trying to figure out how to match my clothes. I wasn't worried about that. In fact, almost every student mentioned either stress or anxiety as one of the biggest problems they're facing. 90% of our students who took the survey marked that they are between 7 and 10 on a scale of how stressed they are on a daily basis. When asked one thing you wish your parents knew about you, one student says, "We hurt more than we show." According to Lifeway Facts and Trends, Gen Z is the loneliest generation. Among the young adults of Gen Z who are 18 to 22 years old, 69% say that they feel people are around, but not really with them, and 68% say that no one really knows them well. So those are. I wanted to read that because I wanted to make sure that I got the numbers correctly, but I kind of want to paint a picture for you, because we got to figure out what factors go into why this is the loneliest generation and why they're dealing with so much stress and anxiety. And so this is the way I can imagine. Well, when Mark was and I were talking, he brought the idea of when your fly's down and you don't know it, and somebody says, "Hey, your fly's down." And I almost did that up here.
Nice job not doing it.
How embarrassing it was for you and the person who's interacting with you, and possibly a few other people. But instead, I want you to imagine that, say, you're going to school. You're wearing new clothes maybe you got for your birthday, and you're carrying your food tray. And somebody scoots out their chair, and you trip over a leg, you fall, and your face right in the mashed potatoes, and your outfit is ruined. Now, what we would like to think is in that moment, there were people rushing to help, pick up, are you okay? But we live in a generation where people would rather take pictures than help somebody out. And so this is a fear that this person has to relive, as every time they go into a classroom, it's someone else showing them a picture that was sent throughout all the school in just a matter of minutes, reminding them of the embarrassment they faced. In fact, they are exposed every day to really millions of critics ready to tear them down and break them apart. We all know what these are. Great inventions, right? You thought I was going to say wrong, right? Cell phones are great. My first cell phone was a Nokia. Thank you. It had, you know, it had an antenna that extended. And I had a cap of 100 texts a month. But cell phones are great. They connect the world. I know it's easier for parents to get a hold of their kids, especially when someone forgets their lunch. But this generation in particular has never known a world without Wi-Fi. And there are benefits to technology. But social media has led to what some researchers are calling an epidemic of anguish. Social media causes you to compare yourself to unrealistic expectations. And so you guys can imagine this. How many of you have, and some of you might, have a really bad fight, and then we'll go online and post pictures of you crying, saying, oh, it's such a horrible day. No, the majority of us, no matter how sad we are inside, we'll make ourselves look nice, that we'll put our best pictures of the most fun event that we have, and you'll put that out for the world to see. And even if we all know that, everybody else who is scrolling through the news feed, seeing everybody else's life put together, and all the fun things that they're doing, has actually created a feeling of missing out. And psychiatrists have actually said that this can actually manifest as physical pain. So whereas before, we had no idea if we were missing out at something at school. Now it's promoted on a daily basis. You have easy access to it, which just shows you or reinforces that you don't fit in. Also, looking at people having fun, like I said, gives you a sense that, is your life not fun? I've actually seen this a lot with married couples. There'll be that one married couple who's always putting pictures of them kissing and all their fancy dates. And I've had a lot of people say, how come we're not like that? Got to live up to the expectations. It almost feels like they have to compete for likes. It leads to a uprising bullying, because where bullying would happen normally at school, or we say at the playground, bullying now follows them home. Bullying now can come to them, reach them on their phone, and reach them through social media. Not to mention that one of the biggest causes today when it comes to anxiety and depression is the idea of being able to send inappropriate texts, in fact, inappropriate pictures. 25% of middle schoolers in a California school said they had sent or received an inappropriate picture. With everyone posting their opinions about the future, and not always factual, this generation is very aware of a lot of the troubles that we're facing. And therefore, they actually have a bigger fear for the future. They grew up in the post 9/11, but also the recession generation. And so a majority of them grew up with both parents having to work to make up for the money that was lost, and also living in the shadow of this terrible terrorist attack, as well as all the school shootings that are going on. At this point, I just want to tell you, students don't answer this, but can anybody tell me what this is? USB port? You would think. It's a Juul. A Juul is a vape. Which is an electronic cigarette. And this is not my personal one. but I got it for this, that this could be passed around and nobody would even know. In fact, a lot of the students are smoking this while in class because it actually has a fruity flavor. And I know that for some of you in the generations, there was actually smoking sections at your school. Well, that's kind of coming back. It's passed off as a safe alternative for smoking, but it's not. In this generation where stress, anxiety, and loneliness are prevalent, students actually have a tendency to self-medicate through a drug of nicotine, just a chance to remove themselves from the everyday stress of life and try something different. But it also manifests in trying of prescription medications. We are in one of the biggest generations of medicated students for depression and anxiety. Also, one of the biggest issues brought up by students is peer pressure. Now, that hasn't really changed. Peer pressure is something that's been around. But peer pressure now is a little bit more confusing and more direct because, again, when they have their phone with them, and the average Gen Z spends 6 to 11 hours on a screen a day. And so this peer pressure is coming in forms of not just at school, but on their phone. It's actually fed to them through TV, which normalizes drug and alcohol abuse, as well as just things like states passing legalization of marijuana has really confused them. And if we are not teaching them correctly, it is much easier to pressure them. And how is it wrong if all these states are approving of it? And these are issues that they're facing. And actually, some pretty scary facts says that the CDC did a study that said 1 out of 3 graduating seniors reported vaping. 68% of 12th graders have tried alcohol. 21% binge drink. 22% rode with someone who have been drinking. And 10% drive while drinking. And a lot of this is simply an escape from their everyday stress. The loneliness is not necessarily attributed to the removal of society by being online, because actually this generation prefers face-to-face interaction more than my generation, the millennials. It actually comes from an uneven balance of sleep, exercise, extracurricular activities, and they actually feel like they're being shuffled around and they're not able to be themselves. So one of the things that's a result of this is that they crave authenticity. Whereas a majority of people, and they know it, are posting fake things, this generation has a desire to be known. They want to learn from someone who's not telling them what to do because words don't really mean anything. They want to learn from a generation that is setting an example, which again is a great opportunity for everyone in this church that we can be setting an example, because if they see it's something that we are real, that we are authentic about, it's something that they feel like is worth investing in. But this is a generation, really, that at any moment it could be exposed to critiques from anybody, and there's really no way to escape it, because we could say, just turn off your device. But the reality is that's not realistic, because in today's generation, a majority of students actually will learn online. They do their textbooks online. A lot of group activity is done online, as well as their connection to the outside world. And so saying, just turn it off, isn't actually really an option at this point. Again, there's great things when it comes to technology, but the pressure that I had in middle school is nothing compared to the pressure they have now. And knowing that any screw-up could be recorded forever online, that would scare me enough to not want to go to school.
That's awesome. That's an awesome reminder, Tim. I actually have been invited to sit a team of people that are part of the administration of the Aurora Schools, have invited a number of pastors and some other resources to begin to address the anxiety and the stress that students are feeling. And the first couple meetings, I got to be candid with you, I went thinking, come on, we all have stress. We all had stress at that age. They just know how to call it stress these days. It's a different animal. People. It is a different animal. Tim, thanks. That's great, great insight. Will, take us kind of inside. Tim did a great job of taking us into kind of their world. Take us kind of inside the home. I know you've been reading some stuff. I know you made observations. Just talk a little bit about some stuff that you see and how we are parenting or not parenting.
Okay, yeah. So one of the response to all that information is we love our kids, and so we really want to keep them safe from all the things we continue to hear, right? And so there's this culture of safetyism, which is maybe gone a little bit too far. We want to protect our kids instead of equip them. And one of the books that has been pretty influential to me recently, it's come from an article It's called The Coddling of the American Mind. Okay, that's what it's one of my favorites. And one of the reasons I really, really like it is because it's coddling being overprotecting our kids, right? Overprotecting our kids because we don't want them to get hurt. And this is by two professors who've just, they've seen some of the political responses in colleges and wondered what is going on in our homes that is have kids respond this way to the opposition. And there's a few lies that maybe we have unintendedly grasped onto. Whatever doesn't kill you makes you weaker. So instead of whatever, we might hear the phrase, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, which isn't necessarily true either, but it will make you weaker. That opposing thoughts are actually damaging to you, which that is not true either. And then the big one is that we want to pave the road for the child instead of prepare the child for the road. Okay, we want to pave the road for the child instead of prepare the child for the road ahead. And you may have heard the term helicopter parenting, right? Kind of always being around. Okay, and some kids might accuse their parents of being those. Okay, but there's that kind of shift actually is more like a snowplow parent. Right? Like, hold on, I'll go in front of you, I'll just clear it all out of the way so you don't have anything to worry about. An example, I'm a coach at Aurora High School. I'm volunteering this year, and we just see, year after year, things are just getting a little bit different in how kids respond to stuff, and their parents, and how they respond to things, too. So before tryouts, we've had different sports, we've had actually pre-tryout emails and texts and phone calls from parents telling us how good their kid could be for this program. Which my dad would have never even spoke to the coach the whole season except for maybe good game coach. Right? Even if he said something completely different on the ride home. Right? That's just a different animal. So there's all these cultural implications that are just different about our homes, and then this has a spiritual impact. Because that also means that we may be lacking in our ability to, or even just our mindfulness in preparing children for the life ahead spiritually. We've just cleared things out and then told them what to think, told them how to respond, instead of teach them how to know Jesus, and this is our mission of our church, to know Jesus, to grow in him, and to serve him daily, to teach them how to do that themselves. So this is the statement that just kind of stuck out to me as I was thinking is that your kid should not actually look to you as the ultimate provider, comforter, healer, etc. Right? They should look at you as, can you please remind me how I can follow Jesus in this moment? That should be kind of our aim as parents and as adults who are kind of pushing into our kids.
Hey, let that sink in for a minute, would you? And I know, I look around, and I know some of you are right there. You're in the battle like I am. You're right at the same time. Some of you have been sitting here thanking God that your kids are grown and have kids of their own. But you know what? God brought you to this church, and this church has kids. So we all have a responsibility in all of this, to see our kids through this. The snowplow parenting one hits me hard. Tommy has been applying for colleges, and I got something back the other day from, first of all, this is just an example of how weird the world is. I got something because my email address is also part of this application process. So now instantly I'm aware of what one of the colleges is missing in the process. You following me? So first thing I want to do is rush to Tommy and say, right now, fix this. Get this done. And what I realize is he's got to understand and own this thing himself. And there's no way that I can care more about this thing than he does and have him succeed in it. But it's this combination, and I'll tell you where it comes from. It's one of the reasons I wanted Will, at least for me, where it comes from. I wanted Will to share it. Is it comes from two things. Number one, I hide it under my deep love for him. Yeah, I do love him. But I also have a fear of him failing when I shouldn't have this kind of irrational fear, because failure is part of what we've all done to grow in life and learn. And secondly, it's this adult peer pressure that, oh, my son has to get into a great university because then you guys will think more of me if that happens. And that's just as wrong. So these, I love that you guys are showing us the, all right, but don't leave us stuck in the problems, okay? We need you to guide us to, and real quickly, because we're tight, guide us to how can we make a difference? How can we be a church that's not just isolating and going, gee, I hope students find their way someday. How can we engage?
So I would say for us adults, right? I have a four-year-old. His name's Sawyer. So I'm looking this right straight in the face, like, okay, I gotta do this well. We want to raise wise kids. Okay, so in the Coddling the American Mind, now remember, this is not a Christian resource, so that's just interesting that it's gotten to the point where the world's seen it. They've got a little, it's called thecoddling.com, and they've got a little section about how to raise wiser kids, right? Prepare the child for the road ahead, and in short, let them fail a little bit. Give them freedom, let them get out there, let them kind of learn what it means to spend all their money where they're like, shoot, I shouldn't have done that, right? And say, sorry, you got to work harder for the next bit. So some of those things that are really good on a spiritual level, really think about ways and opportunities in which they can experience God in a very real way. It could be sending them away for a week on a camp or a mission trip. It could be sending them on a project. They're so capable. They're so capable from a very early age, right? At least at 12, to say, go away for a weekend. There's a variety of things we do as a church to just say, go and do it and tell me how it goes.
Yep.
And just,
yep.
God will take care of them. He loves them. That's my advice to myself.
Tim, what are you excited about with what's coming up?
I'm excited about a lot of things. I mean, when I was asked to do this, I felt a little weird being really the first time you hear from me talking about such serious things. But there's something that I hope you get from this, and that is that we understand, we are looking into, we are researching what is happening in this generation so that we can help put together a program that meets their needs specifically, so that we can be there for them. If that generation craves that authenticity, to know that we know them and love them, we are making sure that we are doing that. And so this is something that I hope you're encouraged about, but it's also good for you as a church because you get to be praying for them because prayer works and we need it. But we are really excited about the opportunity. I know that for myself and my wife to connect, we've been connecting with students. We had an awesome Nerf night a week and a half ago. But we're just looking out for hopefully getting small group. I know some of you have signed up to possibly help, and that might be in small group. And that would be an opportunity for you to be that authentic, that real person in their life, someone that they can go to who, no matter what stresses or whatever they're going through, they know that they can talk to and they're still going to be loved, and it's not going to change how they feel about that. That is something that this generation craves and this generation needs. We're hoping that youth group becomes not one of those things where they feel like they're being shuttled around to, which is part of the reason why they're so lonely, but it's something that they look forward to. And so that's something that we've been researching, and every time I meet with a student, I ask them the kind of things they want to learn or the things they want to do, because I want a program that not only tells them about Jesus, helps them to know Christ, to grow in him and serve, but I want them to look forward to it. Something that they say, this is my youth group. This is where I belong. And if we can establish that, this youth group's going to explode, because everyone in this generation desires that. And can you imagine a youth group where a student walks in and for the first time they can lay their stress at the door and realize that no matter what they say, no matter what is going on, they are loved. That is amazing, and that's the picture that Jesus paints for us in the Bible. And that's what we can be doing as a church, and whether you're supporting through prayer, volunteering, whether you're just being an encouragement to us, that all plays a role in raising up the next generation. And part of the reason why I got into student ministry, because I always wanted to change the world,
And I heard a sermon that said the best way to change the world is to raise up a godly generation. And I feel so blessed that I get to be a part of it. And you guys are a part of it too. We are a church family and a church body. And I hope seeing these students here serving is an encouragement to you, because they are the future. And we want to help raise them right. So I hope you see us as a resource and a partner. There are resources that I will be sending out to parents. So if you're not on the email list, let me know, because we don't have enough time to tell you all the ways to help with what we talked about. But I will be sending out resources to help you.
Yeah, the some people think that the reason a church hires a student ministries guy is just because they like to have a lot of fun and they're good at fun. The secret weapon of some of these guys is they are also a resource to you, moms and dads. They can help you when you are frustrated, when you're trying to understand your child, when you're trying to understand, help me get where they are in their spiritual life right now. Should I panic? Should I freak out? You'd be surprised. They're gonna hold confidence with your student because they're listening ears. But they're going to love you as moms and dads, too, and say, hey, here's how you can be loving your child most effectively right now. Here's how you can be loving your middle school student, your high school student. So don't hesitate to go to these guys either.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
That they're craving, this generation does crave to be with family more than you, than the last few generations. They want to be with their family. And when they learn what they're supposed to do in life by your example, you are in an amazing position. Because what you are passionate about, what you are, and not just talking, but what you prioritize and you show them that it's worth investing in, is what they're going to learn is worth investing in. And so you are in a great position to make an amazing impact, even in the short years that you have, just to be intentional, to be passionate, and to prioritize. It's going to show them what they should prioritize.
Yeah, thanks this morning for being such an attentive, loving church family. Today, obviously, very different than what we typically do here, but it was important, it is important for us to set this time aside because of how much we care about our students and because of how many, for all of us, how many of us have our spiritual formation during our middle school and high school years. So students, I hope you're encouraged today, too, and I want you to know that your church loves you.